Hello and welcome to our Meet the CXO podcast. My name is Claudia Nehmert. I'm board member for technology and innovation at Deutsche Telekom. As we have all experienced during COVID times, this talk was recorded remotely from a home office setting. Therefore, the sound is not in the usual studio quality. We apologize for that, and I hope nevertheless that you will enjoy listening. I promise it is really worth it.
Meet the CXO. Wir reden, was verbindet.
Hello everybody, a very warm welcome to everyone to our AI Action Day edition number 2. I'm extremely delighted to announce an exciting guest, a scientist, mathematician, and internationally prominent TV presenter from the United Kingdom. She explains math so creatively and impressively. She brings science to life in a variety of formats, and I can say she does it in an authentic and very special way. She's a professor in the mathematics of cities, a best-selling author, an award-winning science presenter, and host of numerous popular podcasts. Hannah, it's a great pleasure to have you here with us.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, believe me. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much, Claudia.
So you are probably perhaps most famous from your work with the BBC, no? Whose mission is to inform, educate and explain. And your podcast with Dr. Adam Rutherford, The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry, is among the top half 1% most listened in the world. And it's described as unraveling everyday mysteries. And by the way, in preparation for our call, I realized that you and I have something in common because we both studied math and theoretical physics. We are both curious and passionate about making science and innovation popular to a broader audience. So allow me to start with a curious question. Can you unravel algorithms for our audience in a few words?
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, the word algorithm gets thrown around quite a lot. And it sort of doesn't convey very much meaning, which is a bit unfortunate. I like to think of them as though they're a recipe. It's sort of an umbrella term for a series of logical steps that take you from some sort of input all the way through to some kind of output at the end. So, you know, like a cake recipe, essentially, you start off with the ingredients, which might be data, it might be measurements from the real world, and you go through a series of logical steps to often allow some sort of automated decision-making by the end. I mean, that's very, very broadly what an algorithm is.
So I like the notion of the recipe.
but it could be, I mean, if you are, you know, lost in the street and you ask somebody for directions and they say, go down there, turn left, turn right, use the roundabout and you're at your destination. I mean, that in the broadest sense of the word is an algorithm. It's just that we particularly tend to use the word algorithm to mean something that happens within a computer.
Yeah, absolutely. So how are those algorithms that happen in the computer actually impacting our lives already today? Where do we encounter them? Maybe sometimes even without being aware.
Oh, absolutely, without even being aware. I mean, I was on a filming trip last week and there were a couple of days last week where I was on the screen for 9 hours in a day, right? I think between every take, I was like on emails or something. But I think what you have to realize is that every single second of that time, you are essentially playing with algorithms. It might be algorithms that decide where different icons appear on your screen. It might be algorithms that compress your data and send it off into space so that you can communicate with other people. It might be algorithms in the search engines that you're using. I mean, every single moment of interaction that you have with an electrical device has algorithms hiding behind the scenes, simplifying things and making the act of you using it as seamless as possible.
Yeah, and we often hear nowadays the term self-learning algorithms. Mm. Can you give some examples showing what that actually means?
Yeah, so the example that I like to imagine is that if you, let's say you had a smart light bulb in your house, a smart light bulb that just followed an algorithm would be one that read the time and then say, at 8 p.m. dimmed to half the level and then at 11 p.m. turned off and then made sure that it was on at the right time in summer or winter, but it was pre-programmed. It's all set in advance. It knows you can go through and know exactly what's going to happen. A self-learning algorithm or, you know, a machine learning algorithm is one that actually takes feedback in order to learn your behavior. So this might be one where during the training period, it notices that you dim the light bulb. It notices your pattern of what time you go to bed during the week and at the weekend and whether that's different. And it allows a feedback loop from the data that it's collecting into the actions that it ends up taking. So there are, of course, some algorithms which really interact with the real world like that, continually updating as time goes on. There are others which are still machine learning algorithms which just learn from the data itself. So you start off by giving it an enormous chunk of data and you set it an objective and you essentially let it work out the best path to achieving that objective itself. There are different categories. I'm sort of giving you like broad brush overviews. But the point about machine learning is that you are not writing down every step of the recipe. Have you ever seen Bake Off? It's this cooking program that we have on Netflix. And there's one round where they remove all of the instructions from the recipe. And they have the ingredients, but it's sort of like, bake the pastry, right? And the contestants have to work out how to achieve that objective themselves. So the learning algorithms, as an input, they take experience or data or feedback from the real world and use that in order to derive the best possible path to achieve the objective.
So I hope then afterwards that cake tastes better for the human beings.
I mean, who knows? Who knows, right? It's certainly going to taste different.
So what would you say, in which areas are software algorithms actually superior to human beings alone? And what advantages can we actually achieve by leveraging the power of those algorithms?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So many areas. I mean, I think if you just think about the way that we are having this video call, there's no possible way that you could handle the information that exists in order to sort of beam it up to space and then back down to where you are and so on, so on, so on, without the algorithms that are kind of compressing all of that digital data and so on. But I think beyond just electronically sophisticated input, I also think actually we've known since the 1950s that when it comes to automating decisions, when it comes to assessing what's going on with humans, actually algorithms are better than humans are. So there's a really important book by a guy called Paul Meehl. And what he did, he was in the military and he was looking at people's predictions as to how good different soldiers would be. Right? Whether they would go on to be exceptional soldiers or really rubbish ones, and the assessment of these individuals as they first joined the military. And the people who were very high up in the chain, they were rubbish at making these predictions. So actually, if you derive a very, very simple algorithm instead, then you end up getting better predictions. So Paul Meehl took this work and he sort of ran with it and he looked across the board. He looked at doctors making predictions for how long their patients would live. He looked at like how well individuals might achieve. He looked at the chances of accidents happening. And across the board, even the simplest algorithms that took a few quantitative variables and then combined them together made more consistent and better predictions than humans alone. Intriguingly, actually, the only assessment of humans that was not capable of outperforming humans in terms of its predictive power was an algorithm that worked out whether you're homosexual or not, which implies that maybe this is not like
maybe there's not enough data for pattern recognition, right?
Maybe it's something that's like slightly more innate than them. But I mean, if you think about it, when you're in a shop, you don't get everything that you want to buy, go up to the till and ask somebody to just eyeball it and guess how much it costs, right? It's like a simple calculation performs better. And I think that actually that idea is and remains universally true. The problem comes in when you look at the edge cases, because while algorithms might do a really good job at covering the main, what they are not very good at is understanding the nuance and the context and being able to adapt to the particular situation in which the decision is being made, the context in which the decision lives. And that is where things start to become a little, quite a lot shakier.
Absolutely. By the way, we will come to that in a minute. But before we're coming to that aspect of decision making being supported by this tremendous pattern recognition, I would want to dwell a little bit on algorithms in everyday life. Do you sometimes worry being surrounded with all these algorithms doing recommendations that human beings will eventually get a little lazy and stop thinking? For example, I'm realizing using navigation systems many people, sometimes also myself, lose a little bit the sense of orientation and planning in advance.
I don't think that we have to worry about this happening eventually. I think it's already very
happened already.
Already very clear. Yeah, there's a story that I really like, which is about this group of Japanese tourists. They went on a holiday to Brisbane in Australia. There was a tourist destination that they wanted to go and visit. So they hired a car and they put it in their sat nav and off they went. And they didn't notice the sort of big giveaway that there was a problem was that the word island appeared in the name of the place they were trying to drive to. Essentially, uh-huh. The sat nav was telling them to drive over the water. And they didn't notice this, right? I think that's kind of fair enough, right? You sort of set out and you don't necessarily look at the route in the beginning. But the thing that you would expect for this particular story, you would expect that once you're kind of at the edge of the water and the sat nav tells you to carry on going, I mean, surely you would override it, right? Surely you'd be like, I don't think this is right.
Yeah.
But they absolutely didn't. They did. They just drove out into the ocean and had to be rescued. There's some photographs. Really, it's absolutely spectacular. Okay. I mean, it's very easy to sort of laugh at how foolish they were. But I do think that actually when it comes to putting our blind faith in the output of a machine, I actually think that this is a mistake that almost all of us are capable of making. And I remember I wrote a book called Hello World a couple of years ago, actually probably more like 4 years ago now. And I was talking about this in the book, and there was a write-up from a journalist who worked for the Times who said that they read that in the book and then felt very smug about the fact that it would never happen to them. But then that afternoon, they were reversing and over-relied on the beep sensor on their vehicle and crashed into a tree. And so I kind of feel like, I do think that this is something that we're all capable of doing is, you know, actually, if we can take cognitive shortcuts. Humans are quite lazy, all of us. And if we can take cognitive shortcuts, if we don't have to think about something, then we like to do that. And that doesn't just mean that there's potentially a problem with de-skilling, that actually, you know, maybe my children won't be very good at reading maps in quite the same way that I was or my parents' generation were. But I think it's much more really, I think, about the way that we design algorithms to ensure that they don't, or as little as possible, they allow humans to fall into that natural trap. I think we have to accept that this is how people are and how people will always be. And I think that we have to make sure that we design the interface to our algorithms to ensure that humans don't have that opportunity to just switch their brains off and just accept what the machine says.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talked about the superiority of predictions and pattern recognitions of algorithms compared to human beings alone. And that brings me to the topic of objectivity. And my question is, can algorithms really help us human beings to take more objective decisions, knowing how much they depend on the data with which they are fed? And you mentioned the example of algorithms not recognizing the homosexual folks, and also depending on the view of the world of its creators. So how do we deal with that inherent prejudices inherent in the algorithms themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great and important question. I could speak on this exact question for several hours. So I think that there's a few different points that I want to pick up in your question. I think the first is that when it comes to being objective, I think that you need to be very careful about how you define objective. You know, actually, there are a number of different definitions of that, and particularly definitions of fairness that don't necessarily all agree. You know, when it comes to objectivity and fairness, it's not the case that you just know it when you see it, right? Actually, there are different ways to turn the same object and it can look different from different sides. So that's kind of the first thing to say. I think the second thing that's really important to remember in all of this discussion is compared to what? Because while I don't think there's anybody who is reasonable, any sensible person on the planet who would claim for a second that algorithms are anywhere close to being objective or perfect, what you have to remember is that perfection is not on the table. We don't have this perfect alternative, this beautifully fair system that's just out of reach and we'll go for that one instead, right? What we're left with, if you are not using algorithms at all, is the very, very messiness of humans, right? And I think that it's important to bear that in mind. And that, I think, was one thing that was slightly missing from the big fiasco that happened a couple of years ago around the algorithms that are used within courtrooms. These algorithms, I'm sure you came across them at the time, but these are algorithms that are given to people who are arrested in connection with a crime. Mm-hmm. And they answer a questionnaire And the algorithm then goes on to make a prediction about their chances of committing mm-hmm. another crime in future. And then the judge uses that prediction to decide, okay, mm-hmm. this person should be awarded bail or not. Okay. Now, the thing is, I mean, I know that everybody felt very uncomfortable about this, particularly yeah. when you looked into it and saw the like serious yeah. racial bias. And I am not for one second undermining that as a huge, genuine, serious problem. The thing I think is also worth remembering is just how much luck is involved in the human-led judicial system. So I spoke to a barrister who told me that when he gets a particular case, he knows exactly which judge he wants for that case because he knows how to manipulate judges in different directions. But all of the evidence stacks this up, right? So there is evidence that shows that if you take the same case to a different judge, you often get a completely different response. Okay, that's fine. But there's evidence that shows that if you take the same case to the same judge, just on a different day, you yeah. end up with a different response. Judges who have daughters tend to be much stricter in cases that involve violence against women. This one I really like, right? So judges, they don't like giving the same response too many times in a row. So if three bail cases before you have been successful, essentially your chance of a successful hearing like drops off a cliff. But my favorite one of all is that judges tend to be much stricter in the towns where the local sports team has lost recently, right? And I think that... I'm just giving you the sort of lighthearted ones, right? But now you have to imagine all of the discrimination that all of us see around us all of the time. And that is embedded into these judges, right? There's an unimaginable amount of luck and inconsistency and messiness in the human-led system. And I do think that if you are very careful, that you can create algorithms that will help to smooth out some of that inconsistency, to make the system edge towards being more objective. But what you can't do is create a system that just does the judge's job for them and allows the judge to just take their hands off the wheel and say, oh, it wasn't me. I didn't do it. It's not my fault.
By the way, in business as well, Hannah, I have to mention that here for our audience, because Telecom was among the first to actually define ethical guidelines for artificial intelligence and algorithms. And one of my favorite ones says that the ultimate accountability is with the human being. So you can't say, oh my God, we produce that very unfair tariff system for our customers and it's not our fault because some algorithms we had created was actually producing the results. So the ultimate accountability is always very important, in spite of the fact that, of course, all us human beings are not really objective and so much depending on the context. But that would actually lead me to a question around human decision making. And you actually mentioned the field of law, and maybe you could also argue a similar challenge or opportunity in the field of medicine. How do we then actually tackle the challenge that these recommendations of algorithms might overrun human decision makers, not by design, but maybe just by the nature of our psychology, or maybe even by the nature of some manipulative interests of totalitarian groups or powerful commercial platforms? What would you say, how do you actually address that issues that algorithms can support decision making so well, as you described perfectly, but at the same time, there is the danger that the humans go away and say, okay, de facto, I leave it to the recommendation of the algorithm.
Okay, so I think for me, there are two ways to approach this question. And I think that one of them is a very technology-centered approach. Mm-hmm. And I think the alternative is a very human-centered approach. And I think that they end up taking you to different places. So I think the clearest illustration of the difference between those two approaches is what's happened with driverless cars in the last few years. So when it comes to driverless cars, the earlier ones, the sort of ones that came around 2010, 2012, and so on, what they did is it was technology first, right? So it was like, we've got this great new tech, we're going to put in the tech, we're going to think about the tech first, and the human comes later, right? So the tech's doing its thing, and then the human comes in, and the human will just fill in all the gaps of the stuff that the machine can't do. Except that when it comes to driving, there are things that humans are really bad at, right? Humans are really bad at paying attention. And we are really bad at like being totally and completely aware of our surroundings. And we're really bad at performing under pressure. And so if you ask a human to sit in a car where nothing much is going on for a really long period of time, and then just at the moment when their attention is elsewhere, they have to step in and perform at their absolute best when the pressure is the highest, that is not a situation that is ever going to end very well, right? And we saw numerous people who lost their lives because of that approach to the technology. But I think if you go the other way around, if you go the human first approach and you say, okay, what is it that humans are not very good at? And the things that humans are not very good at is we're not very good at paying attention. We're not very good at being totally and completely aware of our surroundings. And we're not very good at performing well under pressure. And those three things are precisely the things that algorithms are good at, right? They don't care about paying attention, or they don't, you know, they ceaselessly will pay attention and ceaselessly monitor the environment and don't care whether it's a high pressure situation or not. And so I think that the real future of driverless cars, as I think we're seeing now, is that you keep the human in the driving seat and you allow the technology to fill in the things that the human cannot do. So things like collision prevention systems, you know, collision avoidance systems, that kind of thing. I think that's the real future of this. So if we take that idea and then think about the legal example, rather than creating this technology that does a prediction and then tells the human what the prediction is, and then the human has to step in if the prediction is wrong, like, terrible idea. Instead, look at the human and work out what the human can't do. And what the human cannot do is be consistent. The human cannot remove their own biases, and the human cannot remove the element of randomness and luck in the system. So why not instead take an algorithm that runs those same predictions, essentially, but instead of telling a human what to do on each case, instead tells a human how their decision that they've already made fits into a wider distribution. You can essentially create a kind of course correction for people's own inconsistency, so that it's not, you know, this is what the answer should be. It's that this case is an outlier, or you are tending towards this way, or you should be aware that this is how you're treating black defendants versus white defendants, or male versus female, and so on and so on, so that you're essentially creating a little feedback loop in the human decision-making process, which adds the opportunity for more consistency. And that, I think, is the real difference. It's we have to start with humans, because humans, as you said, in terms of the ethical guidelines of telecom, humans have to be in the driving seat. And so it's about designing technology to prevent the mistakes that humans are always going to make, rather than the other way around.
By the way, I like that massively. I call that human-centered technology. Yeah, you have to put the human being in the center and then use technology to complement and advance us, rather than creating something artificial which tries to copy human ethical decisions. I completely agree with that. Yeah. So thank you for that comment. That fits perfectly into our scheme. Apropos human beings, what would you say, in the age of algorithms and artificial intelligence, because you are also teaching and dealing with a lot of young people trying to convey, or really conveying brilliantly, the impact of all that technology, what would you say are the most important capabilities for human beings in the machine age? What is it what we need to be good at?
So I think it's in many ways the same thing that I think has always been the most important thing in teaching, which is critical thought. You know, I have a lot of people who come and study their degree with me, and then I see them a few years later and then they say, I've forgotten everything. I've forgotten everything you taught me. I don't remember Green's function, right? Like, whatever. And I always say, it doesn't matter. Those things were never the point. The point was that I was teaching you how to think, and I was teaching you how to critically assess the information that you got in order to reach a conclusion. And that is a skill rather than a piece of knowledge that you never lose. I think a lot of the problems that I see around when it comes to misuse of algorithms and artificial intelligence, and particularly the overpromise of algorithms and artificial intelligence, I think that they essentially come down to that same idea, which is that people struggle to think critically about the systems that they see. I think humans have this habit, this innate habit of going in one of two directions, either of totally believing that if an algorithm says something, that it has this incredible air of authority. But then as soon as an algorithm is shown to be even slightly flawed, if there's a like little chink in the armor, then I think humans go in completely the other direction and think it's absolute junk and throw it away altogether. I think there've been countless examples of where we've seen this. There's a really brilliant story about school buses in Boston. So they had this really nice idea, which was that teenagers need to sleep in later, right? Their brains work better later in the day. The circadian rhythms and so on. So they tried to reschedule the school buses so that teenagers could have a later start. Incredibly complicated problem. They set an algorithm to be able to decide what the start time should be. It's really a good idea, a decent thing, you know, a first trial. Everybody was like, great, it's going to start, it's going to be an algorithm, AI, brilliant. Anyway, a few of the parameters weren't exactly good, right? And so while the teenagers did indeed get their lions, parents of very young children were shocked and dismayed to see that their kids, in comparison, were starting school at sort of 6:30 a.m., basically having to go to bed at about 4 p.m. in order to accommodate the new start time. So everyone was up in arms and they threw out the system completely. They got rid of the algorithm altogether because everybody was so upset. And they ended up back where they were, right? Which is that they had the problem, you know, in the first place. The thing that I see over and over and over again is that, like, it was never going to solve everything. You know, you needed to manage your expectations and think more critically about what it was capable of doing in the first place. And then when it was shown to be flawed, you didn't need to throw it away altogether, right? Like screeching from one end to the other.
It's an interesting phenomenon. I think it's a great example of that human confirmation bias towards algorithms and also towards other human beings. By the way, out of curiosity, being a mother of two teenage children, I'm just wondering, what would you say are the best means actually to convey critical thinking, especially in ages of WhatsApp, Instagram and social media, where the polarization has even become worse, I think, in the last year. So what would you say are the techniques actually to do so that people, do not stop using what makes them human?
Absolutely. It's hard. It's really hard. And it takes time. And I don't think that there's a silver bullet that you can just give that works. My approach has always been to rely very heavily on storytelling. There's a really brilliant book. It's called The Science of Storytelling. And it's by Will Storr. Love it. And essentially, it comes down to this idea that, you know, the human brain, like, is sort of a dopamine gobbling machine, right? And that is what smartphones, social media, you know, all of the things that are coming out of Silicon Valley have tapped into in an extraordinary way. The attention economy is purely based on hacking the fact that our brains love little teeny micro hits of dopamine.
Yeah.
You know, separately, actually, I think that if you recognize that our brains also really love surprise. We really love mystery. We really love, you know, strangeness. Like, what's this sort of strangeness? And I think that if you create stories that do the job that you want them to do, that deliver the information that you want to be delivered, but you can frame them in that way, that's what the book Science of Storytelling is all about. But you can frame them in that way that makes them feel really engaging and surprising and alluring, then actually I think that you can end up getting through to people and delivering information in a way that you struggle with much more when you are delivering it in a traditional textbook style, but competing with, you know, all of the apps that are available at your fingertips.
Yes, absolutely. So maybe moving away a little bit from children and education to businesses again. So what would you say, what requirements in terms of ethical standards for artificial intelligence should companies be obliged to adhere to, if any?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because I think that we're at a stage now where the technology is progressing so fast that we are not having these kind of top level discussions about the best approaches. You know, I think that we are designing our future by proxy, right? Without ever actually sitting down and deciding what we want our future to look like. And so I think that that's a really hard question. I mean, I'm an academic. I have a professorship at UCL. And as a result, I really strongly believe in transparency. I believe in openness and I believe in like fair discussion. And I believe in inviting everybody to have a say. I know that there's sometimes where that rubs up against intellectual property and commercial advantage, but I think that there are examples of companies who have managed to like navigate that tightrope of being as open and honest as possible while still keeping back some of the intellectual property in order to have a competitive advantage. But in terms of the ethical standards, I mean, I've written about this in the past that I think that there probably should be some unified rules, a bit like you see some of the stuff that people are doing. And it's just like, how are people getting away with this?
Yes.
It's actually amazing. You know, I recently had here in this series a great conversation with Ferdinand von Schirach, who actually says that human beings need to have the right for digital self-determination, the right not to be manipulated and the right to understand transparently how these algorithms actually work. This is actually a huge statement, maybe closer to some of the thinking here in Europe compared to other parts in the world. But I'm also sometimes astonished to see, Hannah, with what people get away. And I see indeed a necessity to have these type of dialogues and conversations and to create transparency about how algorithms are actually functioning.
I mean, I think that point about algorithm, the right to know how an algorithm is arriving at its decision, that one in particular is very tricky, I think, because actually, I think sometimes that can be too much information and not enough, right? Quite often, the individuals who are building these things don't fully understand the ways in which an algorithm is arriving at its decision, especially if you're thinking about, you know, neural networks, billions of nodes and variables, and it can actually be quite difficult to define how an algorithm arrives at a particular decision. But I also think that doesn't mean that we can't just have nothing, right? I mean, there have been a few different suggestions. There was one that I quite liked, although I think practically it's difficult to implement, the example of the pharmaceutical industry, because, I mean, they have a similar thing where somebody needs to know how a drug is manufactured, but it cannot be open information because, of course, intellectual property. And, you know, actually, if you think about it, 100 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, you could just put any old coloured liquid in a glass bottle and sell it and say it was medicine and no one would stop you. And now, you know, you can't do that because it's like morally not cool. And also, you know, potentially causes people's deaths. And I think that that is really the situation that we're in now with algorithms. I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that. And so I think that following that example of having an intermediate body like the FDA, for example, which approves various algorithms for use on public data and public decision making, I like that idea as an intermediate step. Although, again, practically, I don't know how easy it would be to do.
Indeed true. Now, looking at the time as we're coming to an end to our delightful conversation, Hannah, at the end, I would like to have a quick view on algorithms in the field of arts and creativity. And recently we did some experiment at Deutsche Telekom because we took a few musicians, composers, AI specialists. We took fragmentations of Beethoven's 10th symphony and contemporary artists, and we had them all together complete. I'm saying complete here because it was not Beethoven's 10th symphony. And then we applied that also to Robbie Williams' song Angels, and we recomposed it. And I had the chance to actually introduce it even with the artist. So I was actually wondering, what do you think about algorithms supporting creative processes?
That's such an interesting phrasing of that question, because I think that when it comes to algorithmic support of human creativity, I am all in. I think it's a great idea. I think, you know, there's some really brilliant writing about Brian Eno, the very famous producer, worked with David Bowie and lots of other artists too. And he really likes the idea of randomness a lot. So he has a deck of cards that he would shuffle and he would hand them to a musician, and then they would be expected to do something crazy, right? Like, so somebody who'd never played the drums before had to go on the drums or whatever it is. And I think that what algorithms can do really well when they work alongside humans is to sort of fan out those whiskers into the potential paths of the future and allow you to navigate and explore things that you wouldn't necessarily have thought to try. I really like that a lot. You know, that's the human-centric approach. I love that. I think that's true when it comes to art. I think that DALL-E is a really great example of that. I think it's true when it comes to writing as well. You know, I was playing with GPT-3 as a writing prompt, and I find it extremely useful when I have a writer's block to just get me started and then give me something that I can then run with. And it takes you in directions that you didn't necessarily expect to be taken in. In terms of AI created art and music and writing alone, there I'm much more skeptical. I think that, again,
me too, like, by the way, me too.
Yeah,
me too.
Okay. I think that is much more like the technology first approach. Now, I'm not saying that you can't have AI designed elevator music, right? Of course you can. Or, you know, some generic stuff that gets hung in hotel lobbies, you know, for a piece of art on the wall. Fine, do whatever you want. But I think that true art, in whatever form it takes, actually is really ultimately about conveying what it means to be human. And there's a brilliant, brilliant section in the book Gödel Escherbach, which is by Hofstetter.
Oh, I love that book.
It's stunning. But he talks about it and he says that, you know, unless you know what it's like to stand cold in the rain, unless you know what it's like to have a first sip of water when you're dry and parched in your throat, unless you know how it feels to miss something that you know you're never going to get back, unless you really understand all of those things, then you cannot possibly know what it means to be human. And you cannot possibly put those things into your art. And so I really think that very, very strongly, that art and creation is such a uniquely human thing, a unique way for humans to interact with one another and to communicate with one another. And I think that the superficial value of creating something pretty, like you can with Dali, will never, ever replicate that depth of connection that you can get from something that really resonates with you.
Yeah. Oh, I like you phrased that fantastically. I like it very much. And I completely also agree with what you said, that these algorithms help us to explore the different avenues of experimentation more quickly. So you can test out the different combinations and that helps you to be creative. But when it comes to expressing what is really human, and also when it comes to make these unusual connection of dots, which are not relying on pattern recognition. From history, it gets more difficult. And we even saw that in that experiment. So maybe asking you a last question, Hannah. Are you actually an optimist about the future? You come across this one, I have to say. So maybe the question is silly, but I'm always asking people. Are you optimistic about the future with all the things around us right now?
It's a really hard question to answer. I think overall, I would say yes. I think sometimes I worry that I'm using optimism as a coping strategy. And that if I think too deeply about it, I wouldn't be able to continue on. I think that there are some really serious problems. I think that I'm very concerned about some of the things that have been going on and are still going on. I think that we have to be incredibly careful about how we navigate the next decade in this space, because I think that it really can go in one direction or another. But, you know, I also see that there is a potential path to the future where we have algorithms that are, you know, not just capable of folding proteins, which is incredible the difference that is going to make to humanity.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But algorithms that can help us take salt out of water in an energy efficient way. And thus, suddenly there's no problem with clean water for the entire world. And, you know, like, let's go crazy. Why not turn the Sahara back into a rainforest? Or, you know, where you have algorithms that allow us to do nuclear fusion in a way that we have not yet achieved and have an abundance of energy across the entirety of the planet. And, you know, it could be that we end up with algorithms exacerbating inequalities, automating discrimination, creating different classes of individuals. But I also really hope and believe that it is possible for algorithms to create a future where limited resources are a thing of the past and where we genuinely have a new world of abundance. And I think the next 10 or 20 years are going to be pretty pivotal in deciding which way it goes.
By the way, Hannah, I share that as well. If we as human beings manage to actually apply algorithms to these urgent questions of mankind, rather than following the easy path, because it's economically so sexy, to actually use them primarily for digital advertising. So nothing against digital advertising, but when you think about what the digital revolution got us, not yet necessarily the answer to the big problems, even though, in that sense, I'm optimistic, algorithms could play a big role in addressing some of these issues. So, Hannah, thank you very much for being here. It was actually a very great pleasure to have you here and listen to your insights. Thank you.
I really loved that conversation. That was very, very fun. Thank you so much for having me.